This is Hannah Markowitz in Rauner Library on Dartmouth College's campus on February 23rd, 2017. I'm here with Al Keeler, and this interview is for the Dartmouth Vietnam Project. So first of all, just thank you for making the trip to Hanover today to speak with me. I just wanted to start out with a little background information just about where you're from, your parents, your family, anything about that, your early childhood, really.
Oh, good. Well, I was born in Paterson, New Jersey, and my family lived in North Hailton, New Jersey, which is very close to Paterson and Ridgewood, so very much an area that was for commuters to New York City. So my dad worked in New York City. I have two brothers, one a year and a half older, and another that's 7 years younger. All three of us went to Dartmouth.
Oh, yeah.
And we all went to Tuck School on what was then the 3-2 program. My older brother and I went to Dartmouth on Navy scholarships. So we had to compete, take tests, much like the academies. And if you were accepted, you selected the college that you could go to, or you could put in for the college. And if you, it was a ranking system, and it turns out my older brother came to Dartmouth on the Navy scholarship, and when it was my turn to go to college, I had applied to a number of places and ended up at Dartmouth. I had an appointment to the Air Force Academy, but decided Dartmouth was going to be probably better because I wasn't planning to make the military a career. So we grew up in a suburban 50s household, very normal. My dad never went to college, so the three boys were the first in our family to go to college. We played a lot of sports. I was a good student, very good student, and was very fortunate to come to Dartmouth. And then very fortunate to be on the Navy scholarship, because we would not have been able to attend a place like Dartmouth without the scholarship. And unfortunately, it's no longer here at Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. They had closed it down, partly due to the politics around the end of the Vietnam War. And they've tried to bring it back, and it's very difficult to do financially. I think the college might welcome it back, but it's difficult to have a large enough group to justify having the program. So when I graduated, we had, I think, about 35 midshipmen.
And oh, that was just in Navy.
And just in Navy.
Wow.
And there was virtually every, and it was all male then, obviously, virtually, I would say, well over 50%, maybe closer to 75%. As freshmen, we were involved with ROTC or NRTC, mm-hmm. so virtually everybody drilled once a week.
Right.
It was just normal. And this, of course, was before the Vietnam War. It was in 1962, so it was peacetime and a different atmosphere than when we graduated in 1966. Mm-hmm. It was at the height of a lot of the higher levels of action and then protests.
Right. You mentioned your father commuted into the city for work.
Yes.
What was his profession?
He was a salesman. Okay. He worked as a sales manager for Firestone Tire and Rubber Company. And he worked in the Empire State Building and then later in Rockefeller Center. So as kids, we always enjoyed visiting the city and visiting his office.
What sparked you and your brother's interest in the Navy or a military career?
Well, primarily the opportunity to go to college and have it paid for. So we knew we couldn't afford to go to Dartmouth without scholarships, and so, or to an Ivy League school. And so to apply for the scholarship was important, and then to get it was even more important because that meant we could attend Dartmouth. And mm-hmm. I had gotten into Princeton as well, but that was on a regular scholarship, which would have been about half of what I got from the Navy.
Wow.
And I think most people of our generation, or a good portion, felt like they wanted to, it was expected that you'd spend some time in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So being in the ROTC program was very normal and almost expected. So a lot of guys that graduated, of course the war had an impact on it, but a lot of them went to OCS and then were officers, even though they didn't come to school on a scholarship.
So growing up in the 1950s and sort of this sort of suburban area, what was the beginnings of the Cold War at all present in your childhood?
Very much so.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. Well, you know, it's. I think the underlying contextual information was that most of our father's generation served in World War II, which was so cataclysmic. It's hard, probably, for you to understand that. You know, I think it was 60 or 70 million people were killed in World War II. And I think 500,000 Americans, which was very low compared to Germans or French or English or Russians, of course.
Right.
I mean, so it was a time where people were still getting over World War II. Everyone talked about the war, and everybody knew what, when they said the war, it meant World War II.
Right.
You didn't have to define it. And so I think, you know, that was sort of the context. And then when the Soviet Union became so aggressive and negative, and there was this fear-mongering that was going on, there was a real concern that, you know, bombers could take off. And so we did the duck and cover in the classroom under our desks and learned a little bit about nuclear blasts and those kind of things. And so it was very, very much there. And in 1957, when Sputnik went up, that was a real shock. It was very dramatic because it said that the Russians or the Soviets could launch a missile. If they could launch that, they could launch a missile that could hit us. And that was very electrifying.
Right.
It created a lot of interest in math and science and associated things, yeah.
So did your father serve in World War II?
He did not. Now, he was the only son. His father died when he was only a week old.
Wow.
And so he was raised by his mother. And I think that had some element of why he was deferred. Plus, he worked in an industry at that time, not Firestone, but at the earlier time that was critical.
Right, right.
So he was not drafted, and he did some civil defense work, but not he didn't serve. But uncles and cousins and a lot of them served.
Okay. Had any of them been in the Navy or?
No, most of them were either in the Army or Marines.
Okay.
Or Army Air Force, which became the Air Force after World War II.
Right. So you mentioned before that you actually had an appointment to the Air Force Academy.
Yes.
As well. What, could you just talk a bit more about what pushed you to choose Dartmouth and the NROTC program here over that?
I think it the most important thing was that I came to a conclusion, and you know, at age 17, it's, you know, you're just 17, that I didn't plan to make the military a career,
okay.
That I would be like many other people who would serve for 5 years and then it would be a good experience. You'd serve your country, you'd mm-hmm. do your duty, and then move on to other things. And I thought that anyone that went to the Air Force Academy should probably be someone who thought they would make it a career. There was the offsetting factor was that the Air Force Academy was 100% paid for. When the Navy scholarship was, they paid your tuition and your books. They paid for your books and $50 a month.
Oh, wow.
but so my parents paid for room and board.
Okay.
Which I mean, now I have a daughter who was at Dartmouth, 93, and at the time I went to Dartmouth, and for many years it was the cost of college education at Dartmouth was like buying a Chevy. And when my daughter went, it was like buying a BMW and crashing it every year, buy another one the next year. And now it must be, I don't know, it's 70,000 or whatever.
Buying a sports car, yeah.
So, it's a long answer to a short question.
No, that was great. All very important. So you got to Dartmouth in 62.
Two.
What was campus like when you first got here?
It's very exciting. I knew my brother, obviously.
Oh, right.
He was a year older, but he lived in Hitchcock, and I was in Woodward. And I never lived away from home. I never went to camp during the summer. And so it was a big difference. I roomed with a guy who was from Nebraska, a guy I'm still good friends with. And over 100 of us out of, I guess it was about 750, well over 100 played freshman football. So I played football in high school, and it was a great experience to be on the freshman football team, and I got to know a lot of people quickly. And that really kind of got me going, and I think we had a very close group of people in our dorm, Woodward. And so I felt very comfortable right away. My wife and I dated she was a freshman, I was a sophomore in high school.
Oh, wow.
So we dated through high school, all through Dartmouth, got married as soon as I got commissioned. And so my social life was directed towards her.
Right.
As opposed to going on trips and stuff. And I enjoyed the football, and I wasn't a super student the first 2 years, and then I stopped playing football after the first year because we had very good football players. I wrestled the first 2 years and then stopped that, and then I buckled down. I got very good grades my junior year, and that allowed me to get into Tuck.
Okay.
And the Navy allowed you to have one extra year of school, so I was able to complete the undergraduate and the MBA in 5 years, which, there were 12 of us from my class, 66, that were Tuck 67s.
Okay.
So, and then I went into the Navy.
What was the Navy ROTC like when you were here?
Oh, it was interesting. Once a week you would drill. So you had a uniform to put on. And I'm trying to think where we went. I think we did it mainly in the gym. And there was a faculty, and the faculty was made up of officers and some enlisted men. And I was just thinking about this morning, probably because of this discussion. You took naval science courses. So there was, in your first year, was naval history. You had naval engineering. You had naval navigation. And they were regular credit courses, but they were on top of your 9 courses. So during the year, you took 9 courses.
Right.
Navy ROTC took 10. So you had an extra course. Okay. And it wasn't an easy course. But so you had the Navy courses, and then you had the drill. So you've got a lot of understanding of the Navy. And then in the summer, between your first and second years, you went on a midshipman cruise, and I went on a destroyer out of Norfolk down to the Caribbean. And your job was like an enlisted man. So you were lowest of the low.
Okay.
And you wore a hat, a white Navy sailor's hat, but it had a blue rim around it. So everybody knew you were a college boy to be run around. And then after your second year, we went to Little Creek, Virginia for Marine training for 3 weeks. And we went as a group, well, the Dartmouth guys did. And then went to Corpus Christi, Texas for air training. And then after your junior year, you went back to a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I was on a ship out of Norfolk, and the Gulf of Tonkin thing occurred then, and we went back to port, and I got off the ship, and the ship went off to...
Oh, wow.
So it was, you got indoctrinated in the Navy as in the summers,
mm-hmm.
so that when you graduated, you were commissioned, and you were expected to function.
Right, right.
And you were not nearly as good as the people went to the Naval Academy, because they had Navy 360, you know, it was year-round,
right.
365. But you caught up pretty quickly.
I'm sure you were forced to in some situations.
Yeah.
What did you... So you did the Tuck. You got your MBA within a year of
graduating. Yeah, so you skipped your senior year at Dartmouth,
mm-hmm.
and took 2 years at Tuck.
Okay, 2 years at
And that's how it worked. Once you left your junior year, you didn't take any more courses at Dartmouth.
Okay.
You were down the road. Which was kind of, from a social and maturing perspective, it would have been nice to stay with my class.
Right.
But I knew my track was I had to go in the Navy, and I knew I was going to get married.
Right.
So we were, you know, wanted to get that done, and so.
Yeah. So then did you also get, what was your degree from Dartmouth in?
It was in government.
Okay.
But I never finished the major. I just... You know, right. You would take most of the courses in your senior year.
Okay.
And then at Tuck, they called concentration in accounting. So when I got out of the Navy, I ended up deciding I was in the nuclear power program. I could have been a nuclear engineer or an accountant. And I ended up being an accountant. Quite successful accountant.
good. So you mentioned before that the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place while you were on one of these summer tours through ROTC. What was that very, I guess that was sort of the beginning of Johnson's escalation in the Vietnam War. Was that very present among the Dartmouth people who were doing ROTC?
I think people had an awareness of it. It wasn't so earth-shattering, though. It seemed pretty benign.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that the war kind of just gradually got bigger and bigger. It wasn't like the Iraq War where throw everything in and just overwhelm everything. It was always this gradual. It's going to get better. We just need more men, and it just never worked.
Right. Was there a sense at all that did you know for sure that you would be going to Vietnam, sort of your class, while you were here?
As we approached graduation, and again, I'm a little bit distant from my Navy class because they all left in June of 66, and I left in June of 67. A number of the guys... and I'm still very close to that group. We had a tremendous group. Number of the guys went into aviation, and they knew that they would be flying off of carriers and they would be flying in Vietnam, mm-hmm. or high probability. And one made admiral eventually. He was a naval aviator, then he became a nuke. And then an admiral, another guy who was a good friend in college, I'm not as close now, but he flew intruders over Vietnam, and that was a very difficult. So the answer is yes. I think people knew that there was a risk. And the Navy, though, was less directly involved, unless you were an aviator, than certainly the Army. The Army and the Marines. We did have a number of guys go in the Marines from the Navy, because the Marines, despite what they say, is part of the Navy. They saw combat. And so if you decided you want to be a Marine, you knew you were likely to go. Yeah.
Could you talk a bit more about what exactly happened after June 67, what the process was after you graduated, getting commissioned, and sort of what happened next? You mentioned you also got married around that time.
We were engaged for, we had dated all those years and then and really didn't date other people. And so we had got engaged about 9 months before we got married, but we sort of knew we were. And it was, I graduated, I guess it was like June, whatever, 10th or 12th or something, the day before you get commissioned. So you're a commissioned officer then and you're in. And I think it was a week later we got married, June 18th. And I was quite unusual in that when I was at Tuck School in the spring of my second year, I thought I was going to go into the Supply Corps in the Navy, which is sort of the business end of the Navy, supporting the ships and so forth. And they needed extra, there was a request that came from Washington that needed additional nuclear officers. So the situation was that if you said you would volunteer, you flew down to Washington and you were interviewed by Admiral Rickover. Do you know who Admiral Rickover is? You should write that down and look him up. Google him. Rickover. He was the father of the nuclear Navy, and he had Hyman Rickover, Naval Academy, I think 22. He was the guy who developed the Nautilus, the first nuclear-powered submarine, and then a series of submarines after that. And then eventually, when I was in, there were four surface ships. They were powered by nuclear power plants. So most of the people who were in the nuclear power program were engineers, and all of the people who graduated from the Naval Academy were all engineers, so they were prime people to go in. But at the time, because of the Cold War and the Vietnam War, they were building submarines faster than they could man them up.
Right.
So they needed more people to go in and officers to go in. So I volunteered thinking there was no way they would pick an accountant, right? And I had my interview with Rickover, and sure enough, I got selected. So like 2 weeks after we got married, had a wonderful honeymoon in Bermuda, came up on temporary duty station to Dartmouth for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then I had to report to Nuclear Power School in San Francisco Bay Area. So my wife and I drove across the country in about 2 weeks. We had a second honeymoon driving across the country. And then I had 6 months of training in classroom, very, very intense training.
6 months?
6 months.
Oh, wow.
What they call Nuclear Power School. And most of the people in my class, there were 60 of us, were Naval Academy graduates. We were all brand new ensigns. I mean, and over half were just married, just like me. You couldn't get married until you were commissioned.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's newlywed. And you have this school that was, it was 10, 12 hours a day that you had to study. Either you were in class or studying to be able to. And then once, if you passed that, then you went to a prototype. Mine was in upstate New York outside of Saratoga Springs, where General Electric had a demonstration power plant. Actually, once you got inside the containment area, it looked just like a ship.
Mm-hmm.
So people like myself, officers and enlisted men, would learn how to operate the nuclear power plant that ran the ship safely. And you had to be what they call qualified, in essence licensed, by Rickover's process. GE ran the place, but it was under Rickover's control. And then, so it was a whole year of training before I went to my ship, and my ship was in Long Beach, California. So it was September of 68 that I was assigned to my ship, which was a nuclear-powered frigate.
Did you enjoy this sort of intensive training in nuclear power, nuclear propulsion?
In retrospect, I did. It was very tough. I mean, we were newlyweds. I mean, and unlike today, and no one lived together then. I mean, you were truly newlyweds. You were new to one another. And here I was studying 12, 13 hours a day.
Right.
And so it was a little difficult to begin with. And for me, not being an engineer, it was very hard. Eventually, I graduated 10th out of 60th, but I started off the chart. Rickover would be sent a graph every week of where everybody stood. They had to add something to the bottom. the guy showed me. I was so low. And then you had this very intense period where you worked at this prototype. And until you were qualified, it was mandatory that you spend 12 hours a day there. So you were inside this containment building, and you had all this machinery, and you had to learn how to operate it. And so, you know, pumps and big generators, and plus the nuclear power plant itself. So that was very intense, and you had to pass written and oral exams mm-hmm. before you qualified. So it was very hard. And then when you went to the ship, you had to requalify on that reactor. So you had to go through. Wow. It wasn't quite as intense because you had colleagues around that were working with you, and they wanted you to get qualified so that you could help relieve them of some of their work.
So were they really getting into the sort of detail, the nitty-gritty details of the reactors, or was it sort of just what you needed to know?
It was very much what you learned in the school portion of it was all the theory.
Wow.
So you learned, about nuclear fission, how it happens, why it happens, how it's controlled. You had to learn all about the metallurgy of the reactor containment vessel. So there were risks that it could fail, and you had to understand how that could happen. Mm-hmm. You had to learn all of the thermodynamics of steam and how it turns a turbine and how you generate electricity. So there was a lot of theory so that when you were operating it, you knew. You just didn't learn turn that valve and open that switch. You had to understand why.
Right.
Because sometimes it didn't work and you had to fix it quickly.
Was this novel technology for the Navy at the time?
It was, yes. It was. It wasn't top secret. It was classified either confidential or secret, and it was protected. We knew the Russians had nuclear submarines, but we had the first one. It was this Rickover guy was brilliant. He not only helped engineer it, I mean, he was smart enough to understand how to engineer it, but then he was able to put together teams of people to make it work. So it's a fascinating thing. When our reactor, we had two of them, maybe from here to that fireplace and twice as high as this room was the reactor vessel, maybe a little bit bigger. We had two of them, and it would drive a ship for 3 or 4 years and light all the lights. Now, a conventional ship would burn oil,
right?
And it had to be refueled every 3 or 4 days, which was a very dangerous process to do it at sea. And plus, the faster you went, the quicker you burned it. Mm-hmm. We just opened our throttles, and the ship would go. It was it's a brilliant, brilliant.
Wow. Did you know what the role of these ships would be in Vietnam, or were you just?
I did. Our ship was unique in that we were a offshore controller of aircraft. So we stayed in the Gulf of Tonkin and directed planes to go on bombing runs, mm-hmm. and then we were available to help recover anyone who was shot down. We had a helicopter on board that we could launch to help rescue. But I didn't spend much time, and that's why I when I told them that I wasn't on shore or anything, my job was in the engineering spaces to keep the ship going. I did spend a little bit of time on the bridge as we got, the bridge being where you control the ship.
Okay.
That's up on top, and that's where the what's known as the officer of the deck stands. The officer of the deck is the person in charge of directing the ship where it's driving and what it's doing, you know. In the case of an emergency or a combat situation, the captain would take over, the captain being the CEO, the person in charge. So I knew what we were doing, but I wasn't directly involved in it except for a short period of time when I was on the bridge. And it was very interesting because we had radar, and at night, which is when I stood my watches, there was like this cloud of small boats that would come around our ship. Now, our ship was moving. So if you were on a station to monitor aircraft, you would go at 3 or 5 knots, very slowly, back and forth, and probably do a big loop. And we were often by ourselves, so we didn't have, like an aircraft carrier has a number of other ships being with it. And this sort of cloud of fishing boats would come around us. And you never knew. I mean, there could be a combat ship. And thank goodness they weren't doing things like the ISIS does or Al-Qaeda does with ships, that, like the ship in, that was hit, the coal. Remember that when the ship was hit? Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of it, any one of those little dots could have been a swift boat that could have hit us, but never happened. So
they were truly just fishing boats? Or?
We presumed, I would think that some of them were people listening to us.
Okay.
Yeah, that were out there.
What was the protocol when that happened and you would see it on your watch?
You tried to avoid them. You didn't want to run them over because there was always, there were some incidents, particularly with Thai mm-hmm. fishermen that were hurt by American ships, and that would cause an international incident. But if they happened to be Vietnamese or North Vietnamese, I don't think it would have been too much, tears would have been shed.
Right.
And Hainan Island, which is part of China, was right there too. So you went in between North Vietnam and Hainan Island, so there were Chinese fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, back in 67, it was a very 68, 69, 70. China was very closed. It was this big unknown, you know. They're very backward, very.
Right. So you did your year-long training from 67 to 68.
Yep.
And then in 68, you said you.
I was on my ship for 2 years.
Okay, and which.
It was the USS Truxton.
Okay.
So I was on that for 2 years. And then my last year, I went back to Saratoga Springs as an instructor at the training facility.
Was 2 years the length of service that they required from you?
It's typically that you would be on a ship 2 to 3 years because very much like the corporate world, the Navy has you in a position and then changes your job. So you continually are learning different things. Mm-hmm. So people who were on the basic breakdown of the Navy is the submarine service, the air, naval aviation, and then the regular ships.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they call line officers. So I was unique that I was a nuke, and I would always have a nuclear billet, meaning job.
Okay.
So if I had stayed in, I probably would have gone back to another nuclear-powered ship and had more responsibility. When I left the Truxton, I was the electrical officer, so I had what they call two divisions of people, men, under my direction. And so we had probably 70 men. I had one other officer, chief petty officers, and it was sort of a pyramid of people. All of them were nukes, though. So they, all the people that I supervised were, virtually all of them, were trained to be nuclear trained. So they were much better trained than the regular people on the ship. Much higher level of intellectual capability, responsibility, and technical skill.
Do you think that facilitated a different dynamic on the Truxton than maybe
it
on
did.
Other ships?
It did, because sort of the nukes were looked on. Now, you had, I say the nukes meaning, if you're on a nuclear power ship and you were nuclear qualified, you were called a nuke.
Right, right.
And the rest of the people, like the people who handle the guns and the missiles and the torpedoes, the radios, the radar, they were not nukes. And there wasn't any animosity between the officers. There was respect. But when it came to the enlisted guys, I think they felt like the nukes were snobs a little bit. They were the smart guys. And I had a couple incidents with some of my men where they got into trouble because they were a little bit haughty in their way with other people. Hmm. So
towards other enlisted men
yes.
who weren't nukes. Oh, okay.
Yeah. There was a situation where one of my guys got in trouble on the mess line. You know, you get your food on a tray. The enlisted guys did, and the guys who were the cooks were generally probably the least intellectual people on the ship. And one of our nukes, my Navy guy, my electricians, did something to it, and they got into a bit of a scuffle. So you were called up before the captain, what was called captain's mast. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't heard that term.
So on a ship, if there's a judiciary process that needs to take place, an arbitration process, a judiciary process, or a legal process, it goes to the captain of the ship. The captain is the boss.
Right.
And he, and at that time it was always a he, would hear evidence. So if you had this mess guy came up with his officer and he told his story and the officer supported him and I gave my story and I thought my guy had, you know, he had it all right. You know, it was perfect. The captain got mad at my guy for being a know-it-all nuke. And we were both like, oh my God. And usually the punishment was pretty minor. It was more the embarrassment.
Right, right.
To go before a captain's mast was not a good thing. And to what they call, you'd be written up. So there's, on a ship, you have somebody called the sergeant at arms. And they're like the MPs or the police. Mm-hmm. And they could write up a person if they did something wrong. And then there'd be two sides to the story, and they'd have to go to captain's mast. The captain would say, all right, next time you're in port, you don't have liberty. You can't leave the ship. And that's normally what the deal was. And that was very painful because people lived to get off the ship.
How often would you go to port on the Truxton?
On the Truxton, we would go in. We were off of Vietnam for 6 months, and we probably went in 4 or 5 times. We went into a place called Sasebo, Japan. No, we went into Sasebo, Japan. There was a place called Subic Bay, Philippines, mm-hmm. which is very close to where the Bataan is, the Bataan Peninsula.
Okay.
You ever heard of the Bataan mm-hmm. March? Well, it was a great big... The naval base there was probably the biggest staging area for certainly naval forces supporting the Vietnam War. And you would go in there to get replenished for food and... Now, you could be replenished at sea, but generally, it was good to allow sailors to get off a ship.
I'm sure they enjoyed that, too.
Yes, yes. So it was, and we also went into, during that time, we went into Singapore. Mm-hmm. And then on the way home, we went to Sasebo, Japan, which is still a big naval base.
So you were involved with air with Air Force missions that were...
It could be Air Force or Navy.
Okay, and what was the role of the ship? Either, I know you were involved with the engineering side of things, but your role or the role of the ship in relation to these other...
The most important role, we were far enough up, and we had special radar that we could see when North Vietnamese planes took off. So we could warn our incoming planes that the enemy has taken off and you can expect interference. So we were early warning. And then we could also direct planes. So the aircraft carriers, it was difficult for them to operate in the Gulf of Tonkin because of the proximity to land. And they have to fly, they have to go at full speed into the wind to take off planes and land them.
Mm-hmm.
So there were spaces that were just not long enough. I mean, they would risk getting too close to land and too confined. So the aircraft control, once they left their aircraft carrier, which would be further out to sea,
mm-hmm.
directing the planes would be coordinated with our ship.
Oh, so if you were in between the aircraft carriers and
yes.
the land. Okay.
Yeah, so if you had... It's, oh, well.
We can visualize.
Yeah. So Vietnam comes down like this little, you know, it's like a question mark.
Right.
And Hainan Island is here. We would go up between the two of them. And the aircraft carriers would have to stay out here.
Okay.
This area here was close to the land.
Mm-hmm.
There was some risk that you could get shot by a missile, and you didn't want your aircraft carrier to do that. And when they're landing and launching, they're pretty vulnerable because they absolutely have to go straight because these guys are trying to land and take off. So they're very vulnerable. So we were more vulnerable. Plus, we were closer to the action, and we could direct the planes.
Mm-hmm.
I think the targets were selected. We didn't select the targets, but we would know the coordinates where they were supposed to go, so we could help direct them. And then if any enemy aircraft took off, we could. And of course, if anybody got shot by any aircraft guns or missiles and they were returning damaged, we could help that process. I mean, we could either recover them if they landed in the water, which... I think we had one incident like that, and somebody else picked them up, not our helicopter. And then we had, we didn't do any, we got close enough that we could have shelled North Vietnam, but we didn't.
But I mean, did your ship have weapons on, ammunition
yes.
on board? Okay.
So we had a 5-inch 54 gun forward, and it's a more advanced gun than the older ships had and could shoot farther. We had ASROC rockets, so the rockets that we had could shoot down planes.
Okay.
They could be programmed to shoot at other ships, and they could also drop depth charges. And we had the capability, we always said we had the capability of carrying nuclear weapons. Now, I didn't, since I wasn't part of the weapons department,
mm-hmm.
They didn't tell us. I suspect that at some point we probably had nuclear weapons on board.
Wow.
Tactical nuclear weapons, but I don't know.
Right.
And then we had several different kinds of torpedoes, and they were primarily anti-submarine weapons. So we were always very conscious of submarine activity.
Okay. That's actually something that I've been wondering about a lot, because I feel like you always hear about anti-submarine activity in World War II and the beginnings of the Cold War, but never in terms of Vietnam. It's sort of, always just hear about the, you know, the land war that was going on there. So
the Vietnamese didn't have much of a navy. The
right.
North Vietnamese, they had some boats. They didn't have any submarines. So any submarine enemy would be the Soviet Union, and that's it. I don't think China had any at that time.
But so. You were definitely conscious of the potential for a Soviet...
So all of most of the people who went into the nuclear navy were submariners. And people I went to nuclear power school and prototype weren't submariners, so we kept in touch with them. And there's some really scary stories.
Oh, wow.
There are two types of submarines. There's the ballistic missile submarines that are very big and kind of, they're not slow, but they're very big and noisy, noisier. And they carried, I think, 16 missiles. So on the top of their ship, in the middle, was these missile, well, they still are.
Right.
And they can fire them from underwater. And they can only be fired by the order of the president.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You can't fire, you can't use a nuclear weapon without presidents.
Right.
And then there's attack submarines. And these were much smaller, had a very sleek shape. And their primary job was to watch other ships, but more importantly, other submarines. So they would listen for other submarines. Have you seen Red October?
Yeah, I have.
Well, that's what they... That this thing about the Dallas coming around, they do that stuff.
Wow.
It's a very dangerous. So there was, when I was in, right before, let's see, 1964 is when, I think, when the Thresher went down. There's a nuclear-powered submarine called the Thresher, which was an attack submarine that was being tested before it was commissioned, and it was off of Cape Cod, and apparently a valve broke, and water came on board, and it sank. And as you go down, eventually the water just crushes everything. It's like you're in a can, and so everybody died. And then there was another submarine called the Scorpion, and this was probably in 1967 or 69. And it went down off of the coast of, right off of Gibraltar. And no one has ever said what happened, but the sort of the speculation was that they were doing something with a Russian submarine and they either collided or, I don't think there was any proof that there was a torpedo shot, but it was more of a combat and all of those people were lost.
Wow.
Yeah. But other than that, in the nuclear navy, there's never been, as far as I know, any accident on a nuclear-powered ship that was nuclear, the engineering part of it, because the training is so good. And
so did you, when you were on the Truxton, did you ever, how involved were you in the submarine aspect of things?
In my, because I was dry, we were supplying the power to the ship very little. If I were in... what they called operations, and I would have known what was going on, but I really didn't know.
You mentioned there were some scary stories from friends you kept in touch with.
Yes.
Was that in terms of the two submarines you mentioned before, or was that Vietnam specific?
I think part of it was Vietnam, because they were watching off of Vietnam, they were watching off of China. And North Korea, and I think, you know, there's been books published, so I don't have any inside knowledge other than what I've heard and read, but they would do spying, so they would go up rivers.
Oh, the submarines would?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So they were clearly inside territorial waters. They also were able to tap a... cable that was carrying, it's like a phone line you tap.
Yeah.
They were able to tap a cable that was, I don't know whether it was Vietnamese or China or Russia, but it was one of those, and it helped the Vietnam, that war effort, because you got intelligence, not detail of what battalion on the ground was going to do, but more strategic, bigger.
Right.
Picture stuff.
In terms of the the engineering specifically of these nuclear-powered ships besides, were there any big advantages or big downsides besides the, you mentioned they could go for years without being, needing to be refueled?
Well, that was probably the biggest issue. You didn't have to be refueled, and you could go at high speeds for a long period of time. Whereas a conventional ship could go at a high speed for maybe a day, and then it would just burn too much oil, because the faster you go, the more resistance you have. But with the nuclear plant, you're cracking atoms, you're splitting atoms, and it was all contained. And the fact that, you saved a lot of time when you were on station. You didn't have to be refueled. And I think they lasted longer. I think they, because they were built better, they were built to last because of the nuclear plant.
Mm-hmm.
The downside was that you always had to be protected against an accident.
Right.
And they had multiple layers of protections for that. There was a lot of redundancy in every alarm system and every pump system. And Rickover made sure there was a tremendous amount of redundancy.
Yeah.
And then the biggest thing was the training of the people to protect the reactor.
So
I think, that would be the biggest advantage. It's very much more expensive.
Okay, I'm sure.
So the ones that are being built, still being built, that are surface ships now, are all the carriers. So the Eisenhower, the Lincoln, the Bush, the whoever's next. great big aircraft carriers.
Right.
They have two reactors. The first great big reactors, the first nuclear-powered carrier was the Enterprise, and it had 8 reactors. So you had to have 8 engine rooms, 8 groups of people running them.
Yeah.
Much more complicated. The big aircraft carriers, and they're billions of dollars now, are nuclear, plus all the submarines. Submarines are much more... a nuclear submarine has a huge advantage because it can stay underwater. The old diesel submarines were... they had to come up periodically in order to recharge the batteries. They could only run underwater on their batteries, and they'd run out of battery power, much like a Tesla would.
Right.
And in order to recharge them, they would have to start a diesel engine. And to do that, you have to have combustion, you have to have air.
Mm-hmm.
And so submarines are much more the huge advantage.
As an engineer, was there ever a fear that something would go wrong?
Oh, yeah. All the time. No, you were always on guard. And the way that Rickover developed the protection was to go through training. You'd have emergency training activities. So some would be announced, some would not be announced. So you would very often, like, there was the water that was in what was called the primary system could be radioactive. There'd be particles in the water that were irradiated, and it could be radioactive. Mm-hmm. Not super highly radioactive, but still radioactive. And so occasionally you would have to take samples of that water and treat it very carefully, and you could have a spill of that. So you had lots of training about how do you contain that. You'd have training that if you lost one of your main engines, that we had 2 propellers, one of them stops. Right. What do you do? And how does that affect the other reactor? Because now it has to do twice as much work. And so, so you're always training. But you would always be watching everything. It's very, you have to be very vigilant.
Yeah, sure.
And we had, now I hope it's all different, but we had no digital readouts. So it was all before digital. So our temperature and pressure gauges on the reactor were all analog. So there was something that went into breached the wall of the pipe, mm-hmm. and there was a sensor there that then sent an electrical signal that pushed a gauge that went like this. Do you know what analog is?
Yeah.
Versus digital?
Versus digital, yeah.
Yeah. Now the cars have analog displays, but they're all digital. You know, that
just for the look of it.
Yeah, for the look of it. Like the exactly.
Yeah.
So back then, so a lot of what you did was you took a lot of readings of temperatures. You know, people would go around with clipboards and write down once an hour all the readings so they could see a trend.
Mm-hmm.
It also forced you to look at the reading. But when you were operating the reactor, I would sit and there would be three people in front of me and then all of these gauges.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be constantly going back and forth and looking and making sure.
Making sure nothing goes wrong.
Yeah.
So were you were still on the Truxton in 68, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I was there, September of 68 until July of 70? Yeah.
Okay. Did, with the 68 sort of being discussed as, you know, or factually the bloodiest year of the war in terms of casualties on both sides, did that change at all how you felt on the ship, or were you removed enough from what was going on?
We were concerned. There were guys on our ship that would be assigned to, you know, their next duty station. It was a young guy in particular I was fairly friendly with, it, and his next assignment was a swift boat.
Okay.
And so we were all very concerned about him going off to that. The other thing that was interesting, our ship was based in Long Beach, California, and there's a great big naval base, and there's a big long pier that goes out in the water. It's a couple miles long, and off of that is where the ships are. So there's deep water that can come in, and yet it's accessible by cars. And I had the duty one weekend. It was Memorial Day weekend. I think it was Memorial Day, and so the public was allowed onto the base, and we were very concerned about protesters trying to storm the ship. So we had a plan the officer of the deck, who stands where the gangplank is, carries a weapon,
mm-hmm.
and there are weapons available. But we had hoses laid out in case we had protesters come, we could put the hoses on. And so the sense of a great deal of disruption, even reaching onto a naval base, even reaching to the ship, was still... And there was concern about sabotage. You know, there could be either domestic sabotage or international. People were very angry, and, the terrible events of Kent State happened, and people locked up, and, you know, taking over presidents' offices and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, but we were very much aware of the casualties that were going on while we were on the ship, either offshore or once we came back, we went into training. We had to have some work done at... a shipyard, but everybody, I mean, it was pretty not all consuming. It was certainly top of mind.
Mm-hmm.
The war was very much top of mind.
You said earlier that you came back and you were an instructor for a little bit back in New York.
Yes.
What year was that?
That would have been from, August of 70 until I left the Navy in September of 71.
Okay. And what was that, your decision, or was that...
No, it was... So I was ready. You know, I had my 2 years in on the Truxton, and it was time for me to move on. I had very good, what they call fitness reports. That's your evaluation in my duty on the Truxton. And so I was a good candidate to be an instructor. I, at that time, had a... we had a child. Our son was born. And so it was, I don't know whether I put in for it or it was a list of options. I can't remember now. I was probably asked, would you be interested in being an instructor? And that would be great. I thought I could do a good job. It was shore duty with a young baby.
Right.
And so I went back to Saratoga. I had to requalify. And I was very fortunate that the prototype that we trained on was very like the ship I had.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went back, it was like I had basically all the same. Now, other guys could have trained on that and then went to a submarine and then went to another training facility that was even different. But so I was very fortunate. I was very familiar with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good because you felt like you were really doing an important bit of work because these were people that were manning submarines and ships that were absolutely needed at that time. I mean, the submarines in particular.
Right.
And the ballistic missile submarines were the first line of defense against the Soviets. I mean, that would... First line of deterrence,
mm-hmm,
against the Soviets was the ballistic missile submarines. And it's, you know, they talk about the triad that Trump forgot about. The triad being airborne bombs, the missiles that are in silos,
mm-hmm,
and then the shipboard nuclear weapons.
Right.
That was by far the most important because you couldn't find them. You know, you could shoot down a plane or you could direct your missile to the silos in North Dakota, but you didn't know where the submarines were.
Right, right.
So that was a very rewarding job. It was still, as an instructor, I still spent probably 12 hours a day because you're on shift for 8 hours, but you had to prepare about an hour before, and then there's usually paperwork or, you know, things to grade or what have you afterwards.
But, and you were still training people who would inevitably be going to Vietnam or...
To the nuclear ships.
Right.
They were not going to swift boats.
Right,
they were
right.
going to submarines. But they were very important to operate the surface ships,
mm-hmm,
that were off of, like the Enterprise, and more importantly, the submarines. The submarines were sort of the key at that time for... we were so involved with the war, there was such a distraction that it was really comforting to have the submarines and the deterrent of the submarines,
sure,
against the Soviets.
Right, right.
That was sort of the ace that you always had while you were doing this, what turned out to be a very destructive and not very helpful war.
Yeah. That must have been interesting to have on one hand be involved with the, you know, the air, sort of air force or naval aviation that was going in and doing all these very destructive missions, and then having the submarines on the other,
yeah,
hand as more of a deterrent or
a deterrent,
defensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was ultimately when I left the Navy, it was that I just, I thought it was a wonderful learning experience. It was very hard. I worked very hard. My wife and I had, I think we had 8 different apartments during this period of time. We traveled across country 3 times each way, so 6 times or 8 times, I forget. She would remember. So we learned a lot about the country. We had wonderful colleagues. I had wonderful, because they were very highly trained and motivated people. But it was, ultimately, I just didn't feel like I could make a career out of ultimately killing other people. That's just not me. I mean, your ultimate job is deterrent, but at some point you have to be prepared to,
yeah,
kill other people. And that just, I felt like I did my duty. I was ready to do it, but it's just not what I wanted to do.
This may be a difficult question to answer, but do you feel like if not for having your wife and son at home, you would have stayed in your ship position?
No, I might have gone to another ship.
Okay.
I probably would have gone to another ship. They probably would have assigned me to another ship.
Yeah. Would that have been a choice for you?
It depends. You know, if you were a good performer, the Navy has a list of billets, these positions. And so the person in Washington who assigns people looks at your qualifications, where you are in your career, and then often will give you a choice. Mm-hmm. If you're not a good performer, you get swift boats.
You got no choice.
Yeah. Not too many people volunteer for swift boats.
Oh, really?
No. It was a very, very dangerous. Yeah, I don't know if Secretary Kerry did. I don't know if he went on ROTC or... I think he went... Did he go to Harvard?
Yeah, I'm not sure of his background, actually.
Yeah. Anyway, he was an officer, and he got assigned and served admirably and mm-hmm. very difficult. Not good. That was not good duty.
Right, right.
Some people, I have colleagues and classmates for our 50th reunion. I was class president. We just had this past, so leading up to it, we decided to have remembrances of the Vietnam era. And we did it in our newsletter, and it upset some people, and other people were delighted to tell their story. Mm-hmm. So for about a year and a half before our reunion, in our newsletter, we had people write in their stories, or invite them to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fascinating. Some were absolutely harrowing, you know, just awful stuff. Some were aviators that had very difficult, you know, saw colleagues shot down right. and so forth. Others had, you know, these Thailand things that were just, they were doing a job where they had to supply something to someplace, but somebody had to do it and they were there and it was not the time of their life, but it was, so there was a lot of luck of the draw. Other yeah. people got sent to Germany if they were in the army because we had a big occupying army there. My brother was primarily on line ships, but he was in the Mediterranean.
Okay.
So we had to keep a presence in the Mediterranean back then all the time, except for his last year, and then he was on the West Coast on an old ship. But so it all varied, yeah. People, luck of the draw.
Where do you feel your service fell on that spectrum?
Sort of. You mean between luck of the draw or...
Or between, you know, some of these more harrowing experiences.
Oh, mine wasn't... I didn't feel... Only a few times did I feel that we were in danger or I was in danger. So that wasn't it. I felt like we were doing a very important job and I had yeah. very important colleagues, so I'm very proud of it. I think it's by far the most responsibility I ever had. I mean, as a 25-year-old, having responsibility for two reactors.
Right. Wow.
One day we were coming out of San Diego and I had control of the one reactor, and the other reactor was shut down for maintenance. So if my reactor went down, the ship was in big trouble because there's a lot of land there when you're coming in. And that was very fulfilling to have that. I don't know how much time you have, but I have one kind of harrowing story. It's a little bit funny.
I would love to hear it.
So I was spent most of my time in the engine room, mm-hmm. running the reactor and the crew, the team that was down there. But eventually the skipper said, we should have these nukes get out of the dungeons and come up to the bridge. And so I was the junior officer of the deck. So there's two people running the ship, the officer of the deck, who's very highly qualified. He's the guy who actually, when you're coming in and out of a harbor or driving, he drives the ship.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't, there's a guy who turns the wheel, but he's the one who says left full rudder or like, you know. And then he has an assistant. And he would turn over the con, which is the control of the ship, to the junior officer of the deck when things were very calm.
Right.
Like, just keep it going straight there. And after a half hour, turn there. But the junior officer of the deck, on a ship that size, is the boat captain. So on the ship were motor whaleboats. So these are small, longer than this room, but they're traditionally designed boats. They're very seaworthy.
That just sort of sat on the deck.
They're on davits, so they're hung.
Okay.
So they can be swung out over the side and then dropped in the water. Well, when you're the junior officer of the deck and you're boarding somebody, that's a very scary thing because you wear a weapon, you go off in this little boat. Like somebody says, that fishing boat's a real problem. We got to board it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the guy. Now, we had a couple of Marines on board that would go with us, but this particular day, it was Christmas Eve, 1969. We had to move the motor whaleboat from one side of the ship to the other side of the ship, right? And so you put the crew in, and I have to go because I'm the in charge of the boat, and there were three other guys, I guess. And these guys are not nukes. They're regular guys. I mean, they're what they call deck hands.
Right.
They know how to run this boat, but not intellectuals. So we go down in the water, and the water's pretty choppy. So it's going like this. So we take the boat around, go around to that side. And so they drag a rope, and you have to grab the rope, and then they lower the hooks to put on either end of the boat.
Right.
And you have to clip them on real quickly and then lift you up.
Oh, jeez.
And so the seas were getting heavier and heavier, and we're going like this. And, of course, the ship is absolutely steady because it's huge. You know, it's not going to... But we're going like this. And we're, grab the rope! No! So we couldn't get it. And at one point, we got hooked up, and then the back one let go, so we had an emergency drop the front. And then all of a sudden, so you have to circle around to catch the rope. You can't just keep bumping. You have to kind of make another pass.
Right.
So we keep on making these passes. We can't get it. All of a sudden, the ship takes off. Ship just takes off. Disappearing. And I don't think we had even walkie-talkies or anything like that. There's no radio. We had flares and that kind of stuff, but nothing. Nothing. No iPhones.
Can't text them.
What happened was there was some kind of emergency and they had to go someplace. We never absolutely lost sight of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we were very concerned.
Wow.
They eventually came back. We eventually got hooked up. But all of us were absolutely soaked because we're, you know, the water's coming over. So I come, finally get up. So I go back up to the officer of the deck who's on the bridge, and I'm just absolutely, it's Christmas Eve. And he said, okay, go down below and just get warmed up. But it was the most harrowing moment of my naval career is seeing this ship just leaving us in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Just having no idea when it was going to return. That's funny, but also scary.
Yeah. No, it's a good story for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Did you, if you have time, I don't
know. Yeah, no, I put money in, let me see, what time do we start? 2:30?
Yeah.
I'm good to 4:15.
Okay, perfect. Did you have any, I definitely want to read more about him later, but Rickover, did you have any interaction with him besides that first meeting you had where he sort of picked you?
So he was a very, very short man, very ornery. He was very, very, very smart. But he had to buck the Navy. And what he did was he wanted to build these ships.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very successful. Other people sort of took credit. And he figured out that if he approached the Congress and wooed the Congress, he could get money for his program. And it just annoyed the dickens out of the rest of the brass. He eventually got set up in something called Naval Reactors. And it was like its own fiefdom within the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had direct control over the appointment of the officers to ships. Normally that goes through the normal brass, but because they had to be nuclear qualified, and he was the guy who ran the program that qualified him, he had to say, so he would always have prospective commanding officers, particularly of submarines, working for him, so he could pick which ones he could trust. And he was a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bite people's head off, and, you know, people said, my interview with him was only a couple minutes. He asked me four questions, and then that was it. Other people spend an hour with him. Other people who look at you and throw you out, just, and then they bring him back in and throw him out again. He was testing people.
Right.
But he had several peculiar things. He had, he never had many uniforms, so when he went to a ship to inspect it, he expected people to lay out shirts and stuff for him in case he needed one. He always ate a particular kind of grape, and he had to have a certain type of stationery. So if he came to your ship and see, you know, our commanding officer had been handpicked by him, so,
right,
you know, he's trying to make sure he does the right thing. So he came to our ship one day. I never physically saw him.
Mm-hmm.
But because I was about the same size, I had to lay out a uniform, a khaki uniform for him. It wasn't touched. It wasn't used. But I had to lay out. So that was my only... But he went around our ship. I forget whether I was down below or... Everybody was on edge. And all I knew was he was gone. You know, he came and went.
Right.
And he never came down in my space because he... He would go around, literally, you know, touch stuff, and
so it's probably a good thing he didn't go down.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting thing because I was on the board over at Dartmouth Hitchcock for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
My career was in healthcare accounting, and
okay.
And I in my retirement, and one of the guys who's a senior executive there worked for Rick Over in his Washington bureau, and. He had all the same stories. You knew when to stay clear of him, when you heard him down the hall. But other times, we had a tragic incident when I was at the prototype, when I was an instructor. One of the wives and husbands there were loved diving, and there was these diving places where you would go down in an old quarry, and she drowned. Terrible event. And he sent the nicest personal note. He knew of almost everybody at the officer level and was very touching in certain ways. But
yeah,
that's a long answer to a short
no,
question.
No, I was
fascinating
really
man. You'll enjoy
learning a little more about him. Definitely want to check it out more.
I'm sorry I don't have much more on Vietnam. But
no, that was great.
I'm
curious in sort of the trajectory after that, if you want to. So you finished up this, so you were an instructor for a year in New York and then...
In Saratoga.
What led you to then decide to leave the Navy?
Well, we had our second child, and so I knew that the life, and I had very good fitness reports when I was at the prototype. And I would have been recommended to a good job. But I knew it would have been a life of family separation. Mm-hmm. And so it was primarily the family separation. And as I said, I didn't want to have as my primary career goal killing other people, just not me.
Right.
And so I could have, I then looked for a job and I looked at working in the nuclear industry. Because they would hire a lot of people who had this superb training.
Right.
Or I Corning Glass was another company that I looked at. And then Arthur Anderson, the public accounting firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Arthur Anderson. So I had a 28-year career with Anderson.
Oh, wow. And that was right. You began that right after you
yep.
got out of the Navy?
We ended up moving back. Neither one of us wanted to live in New Jersey again, but we ended up living... basically in my wife's hometown, which was next to mine.
Oh, nice.
Which was nice because the grandparents were still there. And I commuted to New York for 4 years and got very good experience working in a big office. And then we got transferred to Hartford, Connecticut, and 24 years there. And then I retired. Right. I don't know if you know the history of Anderson, but it was the firm that went out of business when Enron collapsed.
Okay.
You're too young. When were you born?
I was born in 96.
96. Well, I retired in
99. Okay.
So you're only five when Anderson went under.
I have heard of Enron, though.
Yeah. Well, Anderson were the auditors for Enron, okay. And it was right after 9/11.
Right.
And the chairman of Enron was good friends with George Bush, and they needed someone to throw under the bus, and our firm got put out of business. Mm-hmm. And it was a very tragic event for people like myself who worked.
Right.
I had been retired for 2 years, but I was still receiving some pension, and that stopped because of the collapse of the firm, and so it wasn't happy.
Right.
So, but I always look back on my Navy training as being critical to my business success. And the Navy training, I don't think I could have done that if I hadn't gone to Tuck School. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have gone to Tuck without Dartmouth. So it all kind of fit together. It just kind of, there were building blocks. And certainly being in the nuclear Navy was a very important aspect.
Yeah.
And living through the Vietnam era. I'm really sorry that we don't have required public service.
Mm-hmm.
And military is not a bad, it's such a good way of getting, having your stake in the country.
Right.
As opposed to just expecting something. Do you have any military people in your family?
Yeah, I do actually. One of my uncle, who I'm very close with, currently serves in the Air Force.
Oh, wow.
Now he was in Afghanistan, but now he is stationed in Colorado and has a more instructor type role there.
Does he fly?
Mm-hmm.
What does he fly?
I couldn't tell you exactly.
Is he a pilot or?
Yeah, he's a pilot.
Oh.
And then I have, actually, the reason I sort of was interested in the Navy and its role in Vietnam in the first place is that we have some good family friends who were, one of them was on SEAL Team 2 in Vietnam.
Wow.
Just has been very vocal about that.
Hearing difficult experiences there?
Yeah, I think he also sort of remained, I guess they had a Vietnamese translator who was with them, or worked closely with a lot of people from the South Vietnamese Navy, and has recently reconnected with them. And sort of is looking back more critically on his memories and talking about it a lot more. So that's what sparked my interest in the Vietnamese Navy or in the Navy's role in Vietnam in particular.
Yeah, it was a difficult time because, as I said, the context was your father's generation was World War II. The expectation of serving was mm-hmm. very high, and so it was so easy to kind of...
Right.
The people who were in the military didn't push back at all. That was their duty. But there were a lot of people who saw it differently that, you know, frankly, had it right, probably. It just was a bad mistake.
Did you discuss your service with your kids at all when they were growing up? Or
no. We've talked about the Navy experience, but not from the point of a military life. No, just that it was a very good experience. And neither one served, you know, my daughter or my son, but there was no pressure to it. And there wasn't such a demand. It was before the Iraq War. It was after, let's see, they went to college after the first Gulf War, but before 2003,
right.
So, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, if you don't have anything to add, I'll
go
ahead and stop the recording.
Yeah.